Please note, Spring Awakening does include the subject of suicide, scenes of violence, and scenes of a sexual nature, including allusions to child abuse, all of which will be discussed in these episodes of Piece by Piece. Listener discretion is advised, and the Almeida Productions age guidance for the show was 14+. If you have been affected by any of these issues, you can find free support 24 hours a day, 365 days a year from the Samaritans. You can visit samaritans.org or call 116 123 for free.
Welcome back to Piece by Piece, the musical theatre talk show podcast. This is part 2 of our discussion of Spring Awakening. Our host, Joe Bunker, is joined by guests Amara Akereke, Carly Sophia Davies, Laurie Kinniston, Stuart Thompson, Nathan Omokwe-Lai, Lynn Page and Rupert Gould. Let's rejoin them as they continue exploring Spring Awakening live at the Almeida Theatre.
Welcome back to Piece by Piece, Spring Awakening at the Almeida Theatre. In Act 1, Scene 8, Bendler finds Melchior again in the forest. She asks him to beat her with a switch so she can understand something of what Marta felt. He refuses until she explains that she has never felt pain or indeed anything. He complies and beats Bendler with the switch, and she lies with each stroke, saying she can't feel it. He gets carried away and ends up throwing Bendler to the floor and then runs away, disgusted at himself. That's a lot. It's a big scene. And I have to say, you guys play it so beautifully because it's such a tense moment and there's so much silence and there's so much anticipation in that scene. I have so much respect for both of you for playing it so truthfully and brilliantly night after night. But also, I'm conscious the reactions differ quite a lot. I mean, I'm thinking about that night we did the Almeida for free and there were a load of under 25-year-olds in, and there was they were totally engaged, but they were laughing and there was a lot of like shrieking and like, oh my God. What's it like for you performing this scene, and especially what's it like with different audiences and the different reactions you get?
I find the reactions are younger audiences will laugh more, will sort of audibly react more. And I think that's because, maybe that's because they can put themselves more in our place, and so they feel the awkwardness of it more than anything else. Whereas an older audience might relate it more to their children or their younger siblings that they, or people they know that are young, and see it more objectively, and therefore just be in just horror, just terrified, and more concerned with the safety of these kids and what they're putting themselves into. Whereas, because I think if I were an audience member, I think I'd be one of the ones that laughs, just because I'm like, this is so awkward.
Yeah,
like, this
lots
is
of it
so
comes
uncomfortable.
From that, doesn't it?
And that, yeah, and that's how most young people laugh in uncomfortable situations.
Yeah.
And some of might have been in somewhat similar situations. Like, young kids do weird things to understand things. They're weird and they don't realize how weird it is. And so, it's I think it's about how much you relate to it.
Yeah. My favorite part of that night, though, with the under 25s was that it was all raucous and everyone was turning to their friends and whispering, and, oh my God, and isn't this funny, and blah, blah, blah. And then the scene went on and they knew that, oh, actually, this wasn't like a funny, kinky joke that we're all sharing together, and it actually got serious, then the whole theatre was completely silent.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, we got them. And it was like brilliant. It was like one of the most visceral moments I've ever had on stage was that reaction to that silence.
They were totally engaged. And I think you're right, there's a bit of a laughter of recognition as well.
Yeah.
What do you think is going on for Fender? Why does she initiate this interaction? Because we touched on it a bit earlier. It comes right after The Dark I Know Well. What's going through her head? Because it's quite a leap from the previous scene with Melchior where they've had this kind of moment of intimacy, but it's very new, and now she's asking him to hit her, and which he's initially like, what the actual fuck? Understandably, what's going on?
I think this is influenced, and it's similar to what Carly said about how when Ilse talks about these situations and she doesn't quite know how she feels about it because she feels so many things, but all she knows is that whatever this darkness is, it's something that she knows. And I think that's the thing, it's the knowing, it's that thing of like, I can't quite explain to you how this makes me feel, but it's something I know very, very well. And that, I think that suddenly dawns on her of like, I couldn't even begin to know this darkness, this world. And like, even in the last scene with Melchior, you know, this like connection, this scary feeling, this new feeling, this sort of arousal is terrifying. And I think that exists within this whole darkness realm that Ilsa and Marta are talking about and explaining. And I think it's that feeling of like, I will never know that. I'll never know that. I'll never even come close to that. And I'll always be this person that could get close to it and run away from it until I just have to know. I just have to experience it. Hmm. It's something I have to experience. And, you know, she's sitting there and Melchior's there. And who else is going to be more understanding than Melchior of this feeling of like, there's an emptiness that needs to be filled. And if that comes from pain, it has to come from pain.
There were new lines as well, weren't there, for
exactly.
that scene written by
yeah.
the guys, which is so
it
brilliant.
It adds so much.
Yeah, I can't imagine it without it.
Yeah.
Which lines are new?
Is it, well...
When she says, I've never been beaten, I think initially it was just, I've never been beaten. Was it, I've never
Please,
felt
Mark.
Anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And it adds in, like, I've never been beaten, I've never been in pain. Every day is like a blank... And home and school and church, it's all the same. I've never really lived. And, like, that's so poignant for that character.
Yeah,
because
and
that
for,
explains...
for Melchior to understand that, oh,
yeah.
actually, we are one and the same, and I know exactly what you mean in that part.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that, for me, is that choice in that moment, when we look at each other and we, like, hold that silence, it's him kind of understanding that she's not doing it to make a fool out of him, or she's not going to try and catch him out in some way, that she's actually saying, I feel all of these things and you're the only one who can unlock it, which is
And
why.
She's not just some kid who's envying someone being beaten.
Yeah.
Because that is... Kids hear these... When you're younger, you hear these things and you're like, well, I want to be flawed. I want to be... Yeah. I want to be complicated because, mm-hmm. you know, because you're in everything is complicated to teenagers. So when people have an actual reason or a valid reason to feel complicated, in quotation marks, you kind of want to jump on that because you're like, oh, that makes sense because I'm always sad. So
yeah.
I want to be depressed like Marta is, you know. But I think when he says that, it's like you can't envy someone being beaten. And she's making the point of being like, it isn't that.
Yeah.
It's bigger than that. This will unlock so much for me because I've never felt this. There's something that, like, I think also that bonds them forever now. Once that's happened, it's one of those things that even if they want to forget about it or act like it didn't happen, they're connected now.
Mm.
They're not going to be apart after
and
this.
And it's going to have repercussions
yeah.
later on, which we're going to talk about. Well, you guys do it brilliantly. And I think if the meter of like how engaged is an audience is based on how quiet they are in the quiet scenes, I think
yeah.
you nail it every night. All of you do, because there's a lot of silence in this show, actually. for a musical, there's a lot of space, which is... But you can tell how engaged people are by how quiet it is. In the following scene, this is one we touched on briefly, which is soon between Moritz and his dad. He sort of he tells his father suggests that maybe he might have failed, he might have been kicked out of school. And his father responds with great anger and disappointment, particularly being concerned about what other people will say. And so in response, Moritz writes to Frau Gabor, Melchior's more liberal mum, asking her for money to help him flee to America. He reads out her refusal letter and is frustrated, to say the least, by her reply. And that's in the song, And Then There Were None.
I cannot provide the money you request. Uh-huh, well, fine. Not like it's even worth the time. But still, you know, you wanted more. Sorry, it won't change. Been there before.
Stuart, talk to us about this moment for Moritz and where he is in his, I hate to say journey, because I feel like I'm on an X Factor, but in terms of your kind of arc, what is his brilliant plan and what are the stakes when it doesn't pan out the way you hoped?
I think within his journey, in quotation marks, the stakes couldn't be higher at this point because... He has that duality of mindset that I suppose we all have in moments of crisis, where we were saying before, you look to the people in your life, the sort of harbours or anchors, which, you know, if we're lucky, our parents, if not then partners or friends, for answers. You look externally to go, oh my God, help. And if they're not there or they crumble and go away, it's like, now what? So I think I always enter into that scene and that conversation trying to stave off the thought of, like, you know, no one mine and my father's relationship from before, trying to ignore that and go, no, come on, he's your dad, he'll pull through, he'll understand, something will... And he inevitably doesn't. And so then panic has to take over, and of course that's where he's like, well, I'll go to America. That seems like a great idea, you know. I'll start a new life there, and nobody will know me, I can start afresh, but it's all coming from this place of panic. It's not from logic or peace. It's because all of his olive branches are... dissipate in a way. So yeah, stakes couldn't be higher. And I think especially with it's only in sort of very minimal domestic moments, but I've certainly had that with like really close mates where you're sometimes around their house and you're like, this is amazing, your parents and your life and your couch and your cat, like it's just, this is the best. And I think he has a bit of that envy and then just builds upon it in his mind and his heart. So I don't think they necessarily have an amazing relationship, but he's really built on it. So I think when she doesn't follow through, his liberal, elegant Greta Garbo idea of her is like, well, that's crap.
Yeah, the relationship's never been tested before.
Exactly. And she's like, no, if you're coming around for a couple with my son, then sure, but yeah.
And then we get to the final scene in Act One, which is the scene in the hayloft. So first, Melchior sings The Mirror Blue Night, where he expresses his frustration about being caught between childhood and adulthood and that kind of stuck in that liminal space between the two. And Wendler seeks Melchior out, and he is hiding away in the hayloft. And for this production, the hayloft is not a... It doesn't look much like a hayloft. It's a glass box that rises from... I'm actually sitting on top of it right now. A glass box that rises from below the stage, and it's very tight sort of cubicle, I guess, which becomes the hayloft where Melchior sort of imprisoned himself. The design of this whole show is amazing. I mean, maybe you could speak a little, Rupert, about what your conversations were with Miriam, the designer, and what the concept was for having this kind of glass box, which is going to feature more and more as the show goes on.
So Miriam, who designed the show, is someone I work with a lot, and if I was with her this morning working on another show, and I said to her, one of the things I really like about the work we do is that often she'll respond to the space and go like, I haven't done this in the Almeida before, and she won't design the show, she'll design something she's interested in the space, and then I'll stage it on that. And I find that much more liberating as a director than going, oh, well, these are the themes of the show, this is what it might be like. So the show, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is just a set of steps, really, quite austere and dark. And that came, I think, originally from looking at things like Extinction Rebellion and Occupy and these sort of direct action protest movements that you'd find on the steps of banks or Trafalgar Square or... so it was like a kind of civic public space, kind of confrontational, where you meet our young people. But also, I knew, you know, I'd done a show, King Lear, about 11 years ago that had some steps on, and I always, it's just a great thing to stage on as a director because you have for free levels and height and all those things that give status, and it's impossible not to make a scene complex when you have variants of height, although it's a nightmare probably to act on. But it was a challenge, and Lynn was very worried about it because, like, how do you choreograph on it? And I was like, well, work it out. And we did a couple of workshops on it. But anyway, we had, and I was like, we need nothing. I want nothing in the space. No props, no, I don't want any desks, I don't want any chairs. I just want to do it pure. The actors on the space. But then about halfway through the design process, I was like, there's this one moment that I think we need something, which is the end of the first half, because the couple need to be framed. We need there to be, and we had like an altar and a stone table, and like there was a version where we had trees that flew in and all sorts of different things. But it was, for me, it was all about framing the source crime. We talked a lot about like the Rite of Spring and these sort of like pieces that like build to a kind of, I mean, there's a kind of sense of both tragedy and kind of ritual sacrifice as well as the sexual act. So then it was like, how do you frame on steps? Like, how do you create, I mean, literally like a picture frame? We've done a lot of glass boxes in this theatre, so it was maybe a house style. And there is something about, I suppose, I mean, it's quite a sort of more of a, like a European theatre aesthetic in a way, but I sort of like the kind of Petri dish feel, that you have these organisms in this very, having this very sort of kinetic, sweaty, sort of purely physical carnal experience in this very almost antiseptic kind of experiment chamber, that they go in one way and come out another way, like Schrodinger's cat in a way as well. They're sort of like, are they alive or dead when they're in that box? Well, one of them will live and one of them will die, but it has that sort of, almost like a magician show, do you know, where they might vanish. So yeah, it was just about that really. And there's a obviously for those who haven't seen the show, a glass corridor at the back as well, and it was maybe trying to take that language through.
You also get that feeling of people being watched, sort of enclosed, but also kind of visible, or kind of, you know, they're alone, but they're also not alone. There's a sense that maybe, you know, the community is has its eye on people's behaviour as well. That's what one of those
and confinement as well. Yeah. I think there's something kind of both sort of a bit scary and threatening, but also sexy about being in a tight space with someone, isn't it? It's like, you know, playing, you know, that moment when you play like sardines when you're a kid and like, oh, I'm really close to this person I'm not normally close to, or on a packed tube or something. Sometimes you feel like the physical, I mean, again, particularly post-COVID and so enclosure, that, I mean, it's interesting, I was just thinking that the transgressor in the piece and very much the protagonist is Wendler. She's the one who always comes. She, like, actually, for all Melchior's words, he doesn't do almost anything. She's the one who comes to find him in the woods twice. She's the one who comes to the hayloft. She's the one who is, I think she's the sort of most purposeful, but in some ways the sort of darkest psychologically of all of them.
Yeah, and I've always been interested by that. Why? Because their last scene has ended not very nicely. Like, he's got very violent. He's got carried away in the beating scene, and it's not ended pleasantly. So why does she come searching for him?
It's not complete. They haven't completed the story yet. We've both just discovered even more than we intended to discover, and it's confusing. And the only person that can understand it is the two of us. And so, I think it's a case of like, no, I have to. We have to talk about this, and we have to understand this, because it's gotten to, we can't keep running away now. Like, this feeling is so intense now, and it's become so real that it's actually manifested physically. We need to complete this now. It's not something we can run away from. And I think that the glass box being just this clear box with this stage that has all this writing on it and has had all these projections on it, with this space that has been everybody's space, including the adults, that's like, it's been touched, it's been, it almost feels like it's been, the outside world has been infected now. And we need to just, this is our only way to get the outside world out. And this is our space. And it's clean, it's not been touched, it's not been near anyone, it's not been affected by the words of the adults in our lives, it's not been affected by, you know, the things going through Moritz's mind at the time. We can switch off everything else now because we have this box, and it's just us. And this is our only opportunity to have that and complete this story. I think her only options were to complete this story or carry on living in this tormented confusion of life. And, you know, that's just not an option.
Yeah.
So.
And there's kind of these tantalizing lines which get cut off because Melchior constantly cuts off the ends of your lines. But I love it when he says, something in me started when I hit you. And Wendler says, something in me too. But when she starts to talk about it, he's like, no more.
Yeah.
What is it that started, do you think?
I think it's that kind of sexual awakening, and for him, the knowledge of what on earth that is. And like, you know, it was clearly a bad thing to do because she was there screaming in pain, and yet he was there kind of maybe aroused or something, but then she was saying carry on, and I think she actually meant it, even though maybe she didn't. I think he basically doesn't know what started, but it was just something, maybe even a crude sense, like a twitch somewhere started. Like, and I don't know, that's not really happened ever in real life before. And so I think he does want to bring it up, but there's that dread of that she's there to talk about it. Maybe when he's just lying down in the hayloft going, if it's just me in here, nothing can kind of touch me, it's fine, we're just gonna get on with our lives. And then Venla comes there, and the last thing he wants to do is talk about it, mm-hmm. because she's the only person he doesn't want to see and talk to, because he'll have to bring up all this shame and all these like mad thoughts that he's been thinking on his own. But then actually, her kind of olive branch, as you said, Stuart, is that can't we just forget all about it, and we'll run out and get soaked to the skin in the meadow, and it'll be fine. And then he's like, I think that's his moment to go, just, I'm sorry, maybe we don't need to talk about it, but I'm really sorry about that. Let's move on.
Yeah.
And then they hold each other and touch each other in a very kind of nice, simple way, and then it develops into something
yeah,
else.
Yeah, and the apology sort of paves the way, and they end up having sex with no idea of what the consequences of that might
also
be.
Everything Melchior knows about intimacy is from books,
yeah,
and everything Venla knows about intimacy is purely from her own feelings. And so I think it's that thing of like, I think Melchior uses his intelligence as a coping mechanism a lot, and he's like, well, I know hitting people is wrong, I know putting people through pain is wrong, and I know I shouldn't be enjoying that, so we need to not talk about this. And she's saying, well, but you feel good, and I know I felt good, so we should deal with this. Mm-hmm. And it's also kind of, it's all the things that he talks about with her, in that, like, he's saying, why? Because it feels good. So why are we not doing it? Why are we not supposed to do this? What are we not supposed to do? Not supposed to love? Because I feel love, so what's going on? And it's the same thing of, like, and that's, I think that is what leads that driving moment of her, like, yeah, I have, you know, everything that we've enjoyed together has been operated by how we felt rather than what we think we should know. So let's just keep doing that. And it makes us happy.
And that's what's so heartbreaking when she discovers, when she finds out she's pregnant. How could this terrible thing have come, or what she perceives as a terrible thing, have come out of this, what was quite a beautiful moment. So Act One closes on them, having sex in the hayloft or the glass box, whatever it is. And then Act Two opens, and it picks up right where we've left off. So Melchior and Venra are getting dressed in the hayloft, and the rest of the young people are at church listening to a sermon by Father Colback. And here is the song, There Once Was a Pirate.
There once was a maiden who wandered the mead to gather blue violets.
Not seen the London production, might not be a song you're familiar with, because this was originally cut from the show and replaced by The Guilty Ones. So, Rupert, why were you so keen to put this back in?
I think there's something in the show that the way the lyrics work, like kind of like poems a lot of the time, and they're like almost like sort of Yeats-like poems. Really, I love the fact that they aren't sort of story song, or they're songs with stories, but they're not sort of dialogue in music. And maybe this is the most abstract of all of them. Mm-hmm. It's like, who are these pirates? Where are they going? What is the main? But that's not really an explanation for why. I think when I was working with Duncan on American Psycho, I felt he was really, there was this new technology, Ableton, that he was very kind of interested in, and he's very interested in electronic music and EDM in all different ways. And Lynn and I were like, we love that side of Duncan. Mm-hmm. And so those tracks that have EDM elements, like Mirror Blue Night, beats come in, we were like really drawn to, and thinking like, also they feel maybe a little bit more contemporary. And so when we did some movement workshops, and the only demo we had was Duncan singing it with some of his beats on it, we were kind of really beguiled by that and liked that tonality. And it's funny, my son was saying, why did you cut The Guilty Ones? I love that song. Yeah. And I was like, well, I may be listening to the OCI. I hadn't always loved it. Yeah. And But now I do, actually. I went back to it and thought, oh, it's great. But and I can see storytelling-wise why it makes much more sense in some ways. But I think for our production, the Pirate Song is kind of richly atmospheric, and the visual language that Lynn has created with it as well gives you a sort of fairy tale like quality, which is there in the Wedekind and is there in German stories and Wagner, and the maiden, the hero, the quest out to sea. I kind of like that vocabulary within the piece.
Yeah.
And it's a bit more mythic.
So in Act 2, Scene 2, Moritz is reunited with his childhood friend, Ilse. They talk about Ilse's life in Priapia, the artist colony, and she tells him some stories about being chased by men, drinking, waking up with a gun to her breast. And she sings a song about, well, probably, I'm going to ask you what it's about in a sec, actually, so I'm not going to say what it's about, but Blue Wind, and begs Moritz to stay, but he makes an excuse and says he has schoolwork to do. And Ilse leaves upset, and Moritz calls after her, but it's too late. And tragically, he then takes his own life. So, a lot happens in this scene. I'm interested to know what Ilse sees in Moritz, what she recognises in him, or what seeing him awakens in her, and vice versa. What is, because these are people that knew each other as young children, they haven't seen each other for a long time. What do they discover in this scene?
I think when you're young, you always have that kind of like one friend that you can kind of say anything to, do anything with, and there's kind of no boundaries in a good way. You kind of explore together. Mm-hmm. And I think once you experience that with someone, it's kind of, it's always there. And I've got a friend like that back home, and whenever I see that friend, it's like we've been apart for a really long time, but there's still something that just draws us together that you can't really articulate, that we spent time together, we did things together. There's just an almost like understanding that can't be articulated, and a kind of respect and a love. And I think that's what she sees with him. And also I think they're both quite intense individuals.
I think that's best to say.
And
Can
I
you
think...
Speak for yourself.
I'm speaking for you as well. yeah, and I just think she feels safe with him, and there's no judgment, and she can just... I think she just really loves him, and I love Stu, so it's...
Yeah, no actor
easy
required.
To play that.
And what is Moritz going through there, Stuart? And also, I guess I'm interested to know, how do you feel a weight of responsibility playing a scene about something so kind of weighty and significant in dealing with suicide?
Yes, definitely, definitely. Definitely it weighs heavy, but I think what Carly just said is exactly right for where the scene comes in the play, and also within Moritz's journey in Coven, quotation marks, because there is a moment of breath and sort of beautiful nostalgia to it, where there's always simplicity and nostalgia, I think, which is sometimes lovely and sometimes fucking annoying in life, because you look back and go, no, I know that I was going through a really hard time then. I know that I was stressed and low, but from where I am now, that looks like the green fields of wherever. And I think that's one of those moments where when Carly starts to sing about spring and summer, and like our days of our youth, you know, even at just the age that they would be, sort of 16, 17, everything is just so complicated all of a sudden. And that's not only the extraneous stuff of school and the expectations that are weighed on you from there, it's also your body, you know, and it's not just coming from adults, it comes from your the other kids around you, because they're feeling stressed, they project it onto you. Why are you not at this certain level? Why haven't you done this, that, and the other? And so all of this is going on, and you're like, God, I remember when, like, all I was bothered about was that everybody was playing the right part in the pirate game. And, like, don't take my part, that's my hat. You know, like, that was all that was a problem. Why can't it just be like that? And, like, trying not to, but railing at the fact that it's not.
Spring and summer. The sudden drift of the rain, spring and summer.
My actually going to skip over the next song, even though it's so beautiful, which is Left Behind, the song that Melchior sings at Moritz's funeral, which follows immediately afterwards. The children gather there along with Moritz's father, who weeps over his coffin. Then in the following scene, we find out that the teachers have discovered the essay that Melchior wrote for Moritz, and they blame him entirely, place all the blame for Moritz's suicide on him. He admits to writing the essay, and that's when you get the song Totally Fucked. Yeah, you're fucked, all right, and all for spite. You can kiss your sorry ass goodbye. Totally fucked, will they mess you up? Well, you know they're gonna try. Blah, 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 blah. This number was massively expanded from its original version, which is maybe like 3 minutes long, and in our show it was more like 6 minutes.
And if we ever have another version, it'll be 15 minutes. So I've got a whole book that I'm
Lynn Page
do.
Is ready to do Totally Fucked, the show, the musical. But I guess what did you want to say with this number that you felt maybe wasn't already contained within the number? Because the number kind of works on its own. It is a complete musical theatre number and it always goes down well. Mm. But what was your vision for it in this production in 2021?
Well, I suppose my vision was for, you know, if there was any number in the show where we were able to maybe not completely step outside the musical, but actually make it relevant to 2021, 2022, what has happened in the last 2 years, you know, what do teenagers care about? What have teenagers been through? I mean, I say teenagers, I mean young people. You know, what is absolutely important and relevant and to them now, you know? And I just thought, if we're going to do Spring Awakening the musical, yes, of course, it's a really important piece. And it was a really important piece when it was created 15 years ago. But I felt that if we were to earn the right to do the show again, then we had to do something that was relevant to the here and now. And so I suppose I just thought about everything that had happened over the last 2 years. And I'm really lucky, I mean, that I've got a 15-year-old. And so I really did spend quite a bit of time with Iris looking at activists that she was, you know, she cared about, protests, political movements that she cared about, social injustice that she cared about. Her particular story was that she'd had a lot of anxiety, and I think that was quite prevalent in a lot of young people. And so I wanted it to be honest and real as to now, you know?
Yeah. And then what were the three, because the song sort of starts breaking down after the initial kind of Totally Fucked that people might know from the soundtrack. Mm. In our version, there were three sections, weren't there? Mm. Would you remind me what they were?
We kind of broke them down into angst, which is again very important, very prevalent. Protest, which has been huge and important, and then I suppose the antithesis of that is distraction. So you know, you can. I know with my daughter, on 1 minute she'll be watching you know, some fantastic activists talking about something really important, and then she'll switch to what I perceive as an incredibly frivolous TikTok dance, and you know, and or somebody sort of squashing a banana on their head or falling downstairs, but I don't know, something ridiculous. And this juxtaposition just seems to live side by side in most of teenagers' lives, or young people's lives. And so the third section was about the frivolity of distraction. I think the Childish Gambino This Is America film is one of the most extraordinary pieces of work I've seen in a long time, and I sort of was watching that and just thinking how brilliantly crafted that was. And whereas that, it was just a great inspiration, because what it did was a way of doing something incredibly political. And then it's like, oh, all smiles and jolly, you know, and that's mm-hmm. what we do. We sort of have to get through life and have lots of fun and jollity. But there's just this really, a lot of the dark undercurrent a lot of the time, you know?
Yeah. And just talk to me about the ending, because the ending in this production, there was no button on the end of the song. Mm. It kind of the blah section, the blah 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 blah, kind of ended up kind of looping round, almost like a record that got stuck. Mm. And it felt and you finished with this, the line of actors downstage, right at the front of the stage, you know, yelling towards the audience in a way that felt maybe kind of quite confrontational or accusatory. It was thrilling, and some nights no one clapped, and that was magical. There was like absolute silence. Some nights people immediately broke into applause. Some nights there was a long pause, and then people exploded into an ovation. But I'm interested by, because I was dubious when we started working on that. I was like, doesn't it need something? Just, it's a big number. Don't we just need to, you know, finish it off? But you were always very certain that it shouldn't. I'm just interested in what you wanted to create in that particular moment at the end of the song. What were you looking for the audience to feel?
Well, I think you're throwing it back to the audience. I think you're letting the audience decide what they feel. I mean, it's if you're saying something truthful and honest, and something that maybe is a bit provocative and real and, you know, not ultimately that pleasant, and a bit sort of, you know, basically they're saying we're fucks really, and you just look them in the eyes and go, are we going to applaud that? Is that a good thing to celebrate? Or so I think actually I think it sort of handed it back to the audience about how they wanted to react, and I thought that was important. And what was brilliant is that us getting the choice of how the audiences did react in the end.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it was about looking them in the eyes and going, do you know what, guys, this is actually real.
One question a friend of mine asked was about the speeches, because there's quite a lot of speeches in this where, as the song sort of breaks down towards the end, different people are making speeches. One of them, as you mentioned her name earlier on, is Greta Thunberg. But what are the speeches that we hear, Rupert, and what's the idea behind that sequence?
I sort of did a little kind of what they call a sizzle reel in the movie business on the project, like to give a mood board, and put a bit of a Greta Thunberg speech in a bit of in the break in Mirror Blue Night when you do the heads upside down bit. And I was really intrigued by that sound design kind of working with the song. And so initially we thought we'd do that we would hear in a kind of sound design audio way elements of, I guess because the song feels like it's slightly out of the show in a way, that the show breaks apart in that moment. Mm-hmm. And does it really happen? Like what happens? What's the story of that song? Is there a riot or is there not? The action proceeds as though nothing's happened. Melchior's just, you know, sent away. It's a kind of, is it a strange dream of Melchior's that he lets us bear witness to, or is it a vision of the future in some way that these young people are going to rise up? And so because it's kind of out of the show, I thought, well, maybe we can break and it can be a moment when suddenly we get a bit of the contemporary and the real world. And yeah, it was like a collage of, I guess, sort of people speaking truth to power in different ways, or asserting their own political positions or identities, maybe even, that felt, you know, might be interesting and current. I still wrestle a bit with whether it entirely is the right choice. And I'm sure some people really, really love it, and some people are confused by it, and some people maybe feel it's unnecessary. But what I like is, again, just this sort of sense of passion that kind of erupts out. And, you know, there are all sorts of, it's like a sort of crazy, we've thrown everything into that number, like TikTok dances and Pina Bausch steals and like
vomit,
fires, yeah.
Sick vomiting, yeah, sick's gone, yeah.
Capital protests, you know, additional music, you know, as you know, kind of breaks in the song. And it's just, I think, you know, it's almost more like a contemporary dance vocabulary where it's like, how much can you keep layering on? Like, sometimes you need, I remember I did a production of Romeo and Juliet years ago, sometimes you need a number just to build and build and build and keep building. Mm-hmm. And actually, quite frankly, I'd love it to be twice as long. It would probably break the actors, but yeah. So, it's kind of layering up and trying to... If you're going to break the show, let's break it properly.
So in Act 2, Scene 5, we're in a vineyard at sunset. Hanschen, whom we've met in Act 1, extravagantly masturbating over a picture of Desdemona, is listening to his shy classmate Ernst describe his dream of becoming a country pastor. Hanschen's surprised by how Ernst has managed to stay so innocent and sentimental in spite of all the terrible things happening around them. And Hanschen shares his more pragmatic approach to life and kisses Ernst. Ernst tells Hanschen that he loves him, and Hanschen replies, "And so you should." And they sing a reprise of "The Word of Your Body." I'm thrilled I've managed to grab 10 minutes to have a chat with Nathan Amakwe-Lai, who plays Hanschen in this production. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Describe for me, if you could, the relationship between Hanschen and Ernst. Who are they and how have they got to this place?
Sure. So Hanschen and Ernst are schoolmates. And at the beginning of the show, we see Hanschen asking Ernst if he fancies coming to... huddle over the Homer with him and maybe do a little Achilles and Patroclus. Obviously, that's a gay storyline, which he references there. I mean, for Hanschen, I'd say that Hanschen is very intelligent and probably quite advanced in many ways, or for his age, particularly sexually. I think he's someone who's found in life. I think he's explored a lot, and I think he's sort of got to know the world around him, and he's someone who seems to know quite certainly who he is. I mean, to have developed tastes for sort of, you know, Desdemona style people in books to masturbate over, I think, you know, he's got a good idea about what he likes. So he knows very much who he is. And I think Ernst is someone who is at the beginning of that journey, trying to realize who he is. And I think Hanschen sees this as an opportunity to take him under his wing, show him the ropes. I think also Hanschen can see that Ernst is perhaps into him and therefore maybe gay or bisexual like Hanschen. And so I believe for Hanschen, it's the relationship is that Ernst is obviously quite innocent. And I think there's something for someone who is quite knowing and someone who is aware of all this other side of life. I think there's something quite appealing to Hanschen about Ernst, is that he's pure. Not corruptible. I think that sends him into a sort of villainous kind of predatory thing, but he's pure and he's innocent, and I think there's something quite delightful about that for Hanschen. I think for Ernst, Hanschen's a sort of dangerous bad boy. I mean, spoken solely from Hanschen's perspective. So that's how they initially strike up their friendship, as their kind of study buddies. But I think for Hanschen, he feels like he can teach Ernst a lot of things and wake him up. I think the thing that shocks him is that Ernst thinks he's going to live this sort of pastoral life, and that, you know, that it's with his wife, I think, is the big thing that Hanschen's like, oh, please. So, yeah, I think that's their relationship. But I think the interesting thing is that going into that scene, I don't think Hanschen's expecting it to be anything other than maybe not full sex or anything like that, but, you know, a bit of fun, something. I think the kiss, sure, but I don't think he expects to feel anything more than that. And I think particularly in the version we did at the Almeida, that was something that we all felt, Rupert and Lynn and Tom and me and Jung-si, who played Ernst, was that it should be surprising, a surprising night for both of them.
And he has a theory of the world, doesn't he, that people basically fall into three categories: the people that kind of rebel, the people that get defeated by the world.
Trust me, there are only three ways a man could go. You can let the status quo defeat him, he can rock the boat like Melchior and be expelled, or he can bide his time and let the system work for him. I think with Moritz, so he sees that Moritz has crumbled under having to live up to a status quo that he couldn't fulfill. And I think he sees that perhaps not as weak, but that's not a route Hanschen would ever have gone down. I think he's savvy, and he's gone, right, this is how this works. This is how you stay above it. So this is what I'll do. With Melchior, it's like, you know, it's the opposite end of that, isn't it? It's like speaking out, rocking the boat, like being a bit of a, what's the word, an upstart. Whereas I think for Hanschen, again, that's too much. You draw too much attention. He says, see, he sort of lies back and, you know, okay, so the system's doing this, so how do I extort the system to, or, you know, exist within it to kind of skim the cream off the top, I guess. Because he also goes on to talk about being a pussycat and skimming the cream off the top of life, which, again, I can relate to. I think there's something, he's smart, and he goes, this is the world I've found, this is the world I live in, this is the world I enjoy, and here's how to do it. And I think he feels, especially if Ernst is gay and entering into this kind of code switching and having to hide, it's sort of a lesson in life. I think as well as a lesson in sort of sexual exploration and stuff like that.
Yeah. Which category do you fall into?
In life, yeah. Nathan.
You, Nathan.
You know what? I think when I was growing up, it's interesting because when I was growing up, I was very much a Moritz, like, and a Hanschen, but a surface Hanschen and an inner Moritz. Like, I have ADHD, dyspraxia, dyslexia. So at school, I was Moritz in the sense that, like, no one got why I was late. No one got why I was kind of distracted, staring into space. So a lot of that connects for me. But at the same time, I was always sort of, I don't want to say cunning, but I was quite naughty. I was very naughty at school. So I relate to Berg.
I guess I've seen a bunch of productions of Spring Awakening where this scene can come across as quite exploitative, yeah. I suppose. And you sort of touched on this. Were you consciously trying to sort of vindicate Hanschen as a character? Or,
you can't go into it judging a character. I mean, they always say you can't judge your character, and it's true. If you go like, okay, so he's this gay predator, you put yourself in a bit of a box because he doesn't see himself like that. You know, right. He sees himself as refined and has unique tastes, whether it be that, you know, sexual or how he's going to behave in a classroom. I think he feels he's got, you know, a way of the world going. And I think he wants to share this with Ernst. And yes, I think he's conscious and he's aware of that he is naughty, he is provocative, but he's playful. And I think the danger of a scene like that, and I think we all talked about this in rehearsals, that Rupert was very, very keen that it wasn't this predatory, sort of slightly homophobic way of playing it, that the only gay love scene in this show had to be completely sort of comical and this sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, kind of thing, because that, you know, that's discredits everyone involved, and it's not the truth, is it? It's like nothing in life is ever one thing. So it was about going, okay, well, why does someone behave like this, and then how do you justify that? But also then what we were keen to do is that the second kiss they have, Hanschen isn't expecting Ernst to kiss him. And actually, I think in the script, it's originally Hanschen kisses Ernst again.
Right.
But we changed it so that, and Ito O'Brien as well was involved with this, along with Tom and Lynn and me and Rupert and Jung Si, is that Ernst should kiss Hanschen. That within Hanschen awakening Ernst, he has this a eureka moment and he pounces Hanschen. And for someone who loves control like Hanschen and loves things his way, it's quite disarming. Mm. And that allowed him to be slightly vulnerable, to then make sense of him singing the rest of that song without it just still being him sort of wanting sex or power or control. So it was a really, really great way to do it. And actually it was brilliant because it was rich and it gave us lots to work off as within our scene with me and Jung Si. So yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and it was beautifully tender. And it comes right after that explosion of energy and Totally Fucked.
Yes.
And suddenly it's this sweet scene between two guys, one of whom is having probably his first ever kiss. And the audience, I loved how the audiences went crazy for it every single night. They adored that
scene.
Me too.
Yeah. And we had really amazing, like, we had feedback, like, amazing, the best kind of feedback we had from sort of a young gay guy that had come to see the show and had said sort of, you know, to his friend, who I know, had said, you know, that my favourite scene was that because I was able to see what it might be like, or I don't think he's kissed anyone yet. So it was like, I was able to see what it might be like. And I was able to see myself up there. And we were like, whoa, like, it was amazing. Because, you know, even, well, the thing about Spring Awakening, I think, and why I think that show was so well received and people were so, came to see it 20 times or whatever, was that it did speak to people on that level. And I think what surprises people about Spring Awakening as a piece, I mean, the way it's brilliantly written, and also the way this production did it, was that through the music and through the story itself, you do get these incredibly, like, raw, tender, universal moments that everyone can latch onto and go, I remember what it was like to first kiss someone. I remember what it was like to have my first gay kiss or straight kiss or whatever. Like, and I think, yeah, that was super cool. But also it was great because people laughed as well. And it was like, how do you, you don't want it to be all one thing. Do you don't want it to all be just tender. And, you know, you want to have some fun moments in there too.
Yeah. It can be sweet and funny at the same
time. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me, Nathan.
My pleasure.
It's been really great catching up with you again.
Yeah, you too.
Wendler and Frau Bergmann meet a doctor who tells Wendler that she's been feeling sick because she's anemic, but says, oh, Frau Bergmann could have a word with you, and takes her outside for a talk. And then she returns, having been told by the doctor that actually Vendela's not anemic, she's pregnant. And Vendela is shocked. And it's this really beautifully played moment where she's completely perplexed and says, "You know, but I'm not married. So how could this have happened?" And blames her mother for not having educated her. And she gets, and Frau Bergmann slaps Vendela and then demands that she tell her which boy it was who got her pregnant. That's a huge kind of arc for Vendela in that scene. What is her, I guess, awakening there? And what is the choice she makes in the song Whispering?
I think the slap is a real awakening moment because it is literally what life has been so far, which is like getting closer and closer to the joy and the lack of stress and then hit in the face with something else. And that is what being a teenager is like you find your joy and then you're slapped in the face by it, and you find your joy and you're slapped in the face by it. And she's sitting there saying, "I don't know how this happened, and you know I don't know how this happened, and I'm suffering. Nobody else is suffering. I'm suffering, and I didn't do anything wrong. In fact, I did everything right. I tried to do everything right without your guidance, and now you are throwing it at me." And I think that's the first time where this idea of authority, and I think it's, so the song, and we said this in rehearsals, I feel like the song is it's almost like describing this sort of Ebenezer Scrooge scenario where the ghosts of the past, the present, and the future come forward and show her the reality of life and what life really is. And it's like, okay, you have these ideas of what life could be, and when you're with Melchior, you feel like life is this, but the reality is that the adults come along, they tell you what to do, you try and figure it out yourselves, and then you get punished for it. And that will keep, that's the cycle. That's how life works. It happened to your mum, and it'll probably happen to you, and it'll happen to your child, and da-da-da-da. And that's just a generational curse that continuously exists. And I think that final moment when her mother slaps her is that moment of like, yeah, we're all cursed, and we can't escape it. And then partway through the song, I think, is the moment where she realises it could be a curse, but it also, this might be a saviour. This child that I didn't expect to have might be the thing that breaks the curse. So all I have left now is the hope for the new life. I think that's really a big, big, big moment of realization for her, like a huge educational moment, because before that, I think she really has come to the point where she's like, I figured it out. I just have to trust my feelings and follow my instincts. And I know who I am, and I need to just trust that. And then that slaps her right back in the face. And it's like, and it comes back to, there's a line that Taya says where she says, "How will we know what to do if our parents don't tell us?" And it is so spot on, because it's like, I thought I knew what to do. I thought I had it figured out and everything seemed good. And it's all come crumbling down because my parents didn't tell me, you know? And there's no way I could have known if my parents hadn't told us. It's a lot to process in that moment, which I think is why she then ends up just in this dissociative state of like, oh, this is it then. This is life.
As Act 2 builds towards its climax, a great deal happens. First up, in Act 2, Scene 7, we find Melchior in the reformatory where he's reading a letter written to him by Vendela. The other boys in the reformatory tease him and they get into a fight, but one of the boys pulls out a razor on Melchior. They find Vendela's letter in his pocket and cruelly read it aloud to him, as a result of which Melchior discovers that Vendela is in fact pregnant with his child. Fortunately, he manages to escape the reformatory. Meanwhile, Frau Bergmann meets with a backstreet abortionist and agrees to bring Vendela to him that night. She takes Vendela to the abortionist and Vendela exits with him, crying for her mother. In the following scene, we find Ilse reading aloud a letter that Melchior has written to her. And in the letter, he asks Ilse to get Vendela to come and meet him in the graveyard that night. Of course, what Melchior doesn't know yet is that Wendla has actually died. Melchior is waiting in the graveyard for Wendla and finds Moritz's grave and speaks to his old friend before chancing upon a fresh grave. He reads the name out loud and realises it's Wendla. Wendla has died, and the inscription on her grave reads that she's died of anemia. We know it's actually from a botched backstreet abortion. Melchior takes out the razor in his pocket, intent on killing himself, before Moritz and Wendla appear and sing to him to stop him from taking his own life, persuading him to carry on with their memory. So, a lot for you to play, Laurie, in a solo scene.
Yes.
That journey that Melchior goes on in the course of that scene and during the song Those You've Known?
So that whole thing that you just described, I think, happens in about 20 words or five sentences, and there's not really any stage directions. It's just Melchior bends down, sees Wendla's grave, says no, 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 and then Those You've Known happens. It was wild, and I remember it feeling, I mean, every night it was a bit of a challenge. I think it's the concentration of that and just like the focus of it was the thing that I had to get right. Because also, if you'd not seen the show, I was acting with a stick that was Wendla's grave. So, you know, the set design was fabulous and it looked amazing when all the graves were out there. But for the actual thing of it was just a cross, a stick.
A stick cross.
with nothing written on it. And that was pretty much it. So it was a hard scene to do. But I think the more I then leaned into it in the rehearsal room and went for it. Because, I don't know, when you're in front of all these, your castmates, and they're all amazing, and then you have, you know, five words to have a breakdown, it's a bit like, oh, I don't know, am I doing it too much or too little? And you get a bit self-conscious about things. I certainly do. But I think the more I actually went, right, I'm just going to lean into this and play the truth of the scene and play the confusion of it, the better. And I think there's quite a nice through line for the audience in that when I'd run out at the end and I'd be standing there and I'm shouting Wendla's name and I can't, are you there? Are you going to come and see me? And all that stuff. I think the more I thought, the more you give hope at the start of this scene that he's hopeful and he's not let it crash down on him yet, that, oh, well, she's never going to turn up and that's going to be it. Like, he has that hope. So playing rap from the beginning and then peppered with a bit of kind of confusion and, okay, it is midnight and this is the time that we said she was going to be here. But anyway, moving on, and we're going to talk about something else now and look at these all these tiny graves. And, oh, there's my old friend Moritz. And then you can take a beat and go, okay, she's still not here again. But anyway, let's talk about something else. And kind of the distraction of it, I think as an audience, you're then watching someone going, I know that she's dead and he doesn't. And I think that even if when you get to that final moment where you see her, isn't the most like extraordinary powerful bit of acting, as the audience, that whole run up, you go, oh God, you're just waiting for that moment where he realizes, basically. So that's why.
Because in his head, he's escaped from this terrible reformatory and she's run away from her parents, he thinks.
Yeah.
And they're going to meet together. They're going to have their baby somewhere and start a new life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're right, there's not a great deal of hope in the show in general, but there is this little sliver at the end. You think, yeah, this could actually... Oh, no.
No.
So what does he... So he's there with this razor in his hand, thinking he is without hope and there's nothing left for him. What is the discovery of Those You've Known, that final song? And who are they? Are they ghosts? Are they his subconscious? Are they... Or does it not matter? What did you...
That's a good question.
In your head.
I think they're ghosts in the sense that they are spirits there with him, but I doubt that they're actually there with him. You know, he's there on his own. If you're doing the film version, there'd be a shot where they're all three of them are singing together, and then you'd cut away to something else, and then you'd cut back, and it's just Melchior there on his own, and the two aren't there. It's quite tricky to know, really. And I think sometimes it changed and sometimes it's like, right, we all are here together. But then the lyrics in the song is like, he says, I'm all alone, but still I hear them yearning and I'm calling from longing. So clearly he knows that they're not there. And actually during the choreography of that song, the way we staged it, we never actually look at each other until the very end, which is when Carly starts singing the final song, which is beautiful. We never actually embrace or touch each other until that moment. So I feel like, yeah, maybe they weren't really there with him, but but also they were there with him, and he could feel it. And I, like, we do embrace at the end, and it was a lovely moment for us three to be able to connect again at the end of that show. And it did always make me feel very sad when I'm there and Wendler's died, and then Stuart starts singing, and I'm like, Moritz, is that actually you? Please help me. It was good fun. It was challenging. It really was.
All alone, but still I hear their yearning. Through the dark, the moon alone, they're burning. The stars too, they tell of spring returning. And summer with another wind that no one yet has known. Though you call me, there's so much more to
And it calls back that song, because obviously the first song you sing is All That's Known.
Mm-hmm.
And in a kind of beautiful kind of symmetry, that's the second song in the show. And then the second song from the end is Those You've Known.
Yeah, true.
What's the kind of discovery that he's made, like, between the first one and the second one, do you think, as a person?
So in the first one, he wants to change the world. He can't believe that anybody else doesn't see like him, and that everything's a lie and everything's okay, and unless it's scripted in their Bible, and like, you know, we're all running from this fake authority who doesn't give a shit about us. And then by the end, I think he still does have that drive and that passion to change the world, but I think it's more about changing, like, his own world, as opposed to I'm going to change everything. It's like, how am I going to just bend it through for me? And by doing that, maybe I'll keep my best friend and my love with me, and I'll go out and I'll keep their name alive, and I'll read their dreams to the stars, but it'll be more about me and my life and how I'll live my life, as opposed to how everyone should live theirs.
Like, it feels like it has something to tell us about friendship as well.
Yeah.
The family figures have all failed the children. So all the biological parents have failed their children, either by keeping the truth from them or treating them harshly or outright abusing them or disowning them.
Yeah.
That the final image that we see before this epilogue of the Song of Purple Summer is these three friends who were kind of, you know, two of them are dead, but they are the only people that have demonstrated loyalty.
Yeah, 100%.
Is it hopeful, the ending? Can it be hopeful?
I think so. I think it is. It's sad, but I think hope often comes out of sadness. You need something to look to in times of sadness. So I think, you know, that final image of us three there and someone going, no, well, I could let this squash me and kill me, but I'm actually going to try and fight it. I'm going to try. I might not necessarily win it at all times, but I'm going to try it this time. And then, you know, Carly comes on, she sings like an angel, and then everybody else starts singing. We all kind of rise one by one and have that like moment with each other. I think it was actually really important for us as a company to have that moment together at the end, in terms of how we felt after the show and be able to see each other again on there and all sing an absolutely beautiful song in such perfect choral harmony. I absolutely love it. It's the first thing we started rehearsing in our first rehearsal, and to then get to do that at the end of every night, I think was a very special moment for everyone. And hopefully it does feel full of hope and feel like it's cast somewhere in the future, and these people kind of are okay. Because also in that final moment, as I'd walk up the steps after that final moment with Those You've Known, you very much Melchior and Wendler and Moritz at that point. But then as this song flows, I think we kind of like, you take off your armor a wee bit and you slightly become just a part of a company again, as opposed to like each individual. Like, I wasn't necessarily singing that song as Melchior in the way that I do in All That's Known in any way. I think it was a totally different kind of place.
Yeah, it feels like a coda, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It feels like Those You've Known is the finale of the show in a sense. In the sense of like, that's the end of the story, the narrative arc. And then this is kind of sort of postscript,
yeah.
I suppose. There's what I love what you said about trying, this idea that I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to try. I'm going to carry on. Because it's something that Stephen wrote in his book, you know, his book, Purple Summer, notes on the lyrics of Spring Awakening. And he talks about this final song and when they translated it into German for a production in German. And the different translations they had tried. And he said, the initial translations of this lyric have been too sentimental and celebratory. Over the course of the show, we have gone through so much heartache with the characters. We never meant to deny all that with some final anthem. Rather, we wanted to affirm that in spite of the darkness, life somehow goes on.
Mm.
And I think that's really interesting because I have had conversations with people before where they've said, oh, but isn't the ending a bit kind of neat? Because it's been so bleak.
Yeah.
But I think, like you say, as an audience and it's interesting you say as a cast member, you actually need that moment of affirmation and togetherness because otherwise it is
totally. I think
incredibly sad.
You wouldn't want everyone. And I think those you've known does have an aspect of hope in it as well. And like, as we say, he's going to go out there and it'll be sad, but he'll probably get through it. If it did end on that note and it was a very slow kind of spotlight fade down to a blackout, I think people would feel very different leaving the theatre as opposed to like being there kind of held by everyone at the end.
Yeah.
It was a joy to do it.
Just to round off, Lynn, what was your favourite thing about this production? What's the thing that you're most pleased with or that you sort of can remember most fondly about the whole experience?
I remember waiting to start the show in March 2020 and that window between starting the show in beginning of October 21 was that sometimes I would play Purple Summer in the car just as a sort of a mirage in a desert of going, one day this is going to happen, one day. And so my favourite moment of all time, and it's a deep-seated, emotional moment for me was actually being live in the room and actually having our group of people and actually singing that song and going, oh, we're here. We're actually here. This group of extraordinary, young, amazingly talented people, clever people, our amazing creative team. We're all in one room, we're all in the Almeida, and we're singing the song, and hallelujah, we got here. You know, it was like the rescue had happened.
I'd love to carry on talking with you about this for hours because you're all incredibly eloquent, even when you protest that you're not. But just to round off, just give me in three words, what is Spring Awakening for you? The experience of performing it or the show? Go, Laurie.
Energetic, anthemic, joy.
Love it. What's the best thing about the show for you, Carly?
I love Mirror Blue Night.
Oh,
I
rogue choice.
I love coming up the hatch. That is my highlight.
Oh my God,
and I'm not just saying it for a laugh. Genuinely.
What about you, Amara? You can pick three words or best thing.
Best thing, it genuinely feels like a really real accurate representation of being a teenager. And it's one of the few pieces of media, I think, about teenagers that really feels like it comes from teenagers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's really astute. Yeah. Stu.
Three words.
Go on, three words.
Emotional.
Yeah. Understatement. Yep.
Raucous. And alive. Because that's how it's made me feel and that's what it is to do it and all of that.
Do you want to go?
I would say beautiful. I think it's gorgeous. Intimate, particularly at the Almeida, but I think the show is. And alive.
There we go. Alive is the word. Thank you so much, This has been Piece by Piece Spring Awakening at the Almeida.
Thank you for listening to Piece by Piece Spring Awakening. Our guests were Amara Akereke, Carly Sophia Davies, Laurie Kinniston, Stuart Thompson, Nathan Amarkwe Lai, Lynn Page and Rupert Gould, with many thanks to Priya Patel Appleby and to everyone at the Almeida Theatre. Piece by Piece is devised and presented by Joe Bunker and produced and edited by Nikki Davison for Auburn Jam Music, with assistant production from Emma Maywood. Our theme music is by Ben Cox, and our executive producer is Blake Klein for Pint of Wine. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @PBP_podcast or email us with your thoughts. piecebypiecetalkshow@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to Piece by Piece. Please do join us again.